from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitine.
Good morning. Happy Tuesday to all of you. It is September 26th. Thank you so much for joining us on the G and Ursula Show. G is off today. Felix Bunnell is in, our resident historian. Good morning.
Good to see you guys again.
We have another packed show for you coming up in the 9:30 segment. Chris Sullivan's going to join us, and he's going to talk about why freeways could get new color lane striping. And have you noticed that there's some stretches of freeway where it's almost like you're driving by Braille?
Oh, totally. These huge puddles of standing water and stuff that come up here every season. The new 520, which I was driving last night, the height of the storm. No water problems at all between Montlake and the other side of Evergreen Point, the other side of the bridge.
Well, I want to hear from you. If you have a stretch of freeway where you're like, okay, we need help over here, text us. 888-973-5476. 888-973 is our state roofing text line. And we look forward to hearing from you. Just a reminder that you are a very important part of our show. And right now, it's time for our top stories brought to you by Wayscar Ford Isuzu in Auburn. After months and months of contentious debate, the Burien City Council is finally banning camping in public spaces overnight. This controversial ordinance goes into effect November 1st, and we get more now live from our reporter, Sam Campbell.
Ursula, you know that I've been covering this story for several months.
Yes.
And, you know, nearly every open city council meeting, there has been a lot of pressure on both sides from residents in the community to address the crisis that they're having with homelessness. And in that meantime, there has been a series of encampments in Burien that have been cleared, and then they pop back up sometimes just a few blocks away.
Right.
And so that has only added to growing frustration in the community about getting some kind of, you know, overarching solution on the books. And, you know, tensions have occasionally reached a boiling point. I don't think I got to talk to you when I was covering the last time I was on this, the last time that they were meeting about this. And the deputy mayor, Kevin Schilling, had admonished one resident who spoke out after one of the other council members made a claim that pushing these homeless people between sites was actually white supremacy. And then the resident speaks out, and then Deputy Mayor Kevin Schilling says this.
No audience remarks while council is speaking. Thank you very much. If you yell again, Darla, I will ask you to leave.
And so that's just, you know, Darla, a small soundbite.
I like the small town feel, though. They can talk to people by their first name only. Kind of Mayberry RFD kind of thing.
You're right. But you could almost put this in every city council meeting because you have the same battle going on city after city.
Yep.
And this is just, you know, a small microcosm that I'm choosing to show with everyone to illustrate the tensions that are surrounding this controversy. And at the center of it, there are these people who it's a revolving group in Burien who are living in the camps. And we've actually spoken with some of them, and they tell us, well, let's just let them say it.
I feel like crap. It's wrong. I mean, they make people move from one site to another site.
Dude said, go home. They're driving by like, go home. What do you mean go home? We're out here because we got no home.
So now they and any others living unhoused in Burien are going to risk misdemeanors if they continue sleeping outside. But that's only if shelter space is available. Burien's new ban, it's called Ordinance 818. It defines unlawful public camping as anyone staying overnight in streets, sidewalks, parks, or outside municipal buildings. And it's going to go into effect 36 days from now. But with that being said, there's still questions on how authorities will possibly enforce this law. Council member Sydney Moore has been an, you know, outspoken critic of a camping ban in Burien, and she voted against it. But it still passed, and she's skeptical of there being shelter availability, to actually house the people who need it. And she's questioning how police can keep track of it. So that's being debated still, and I've reached out to the King County Sheriff's Office, who contracts with Burien, to ask them how they plan on enforcing this new ban. I have not received a result yet. But this is probably the result that many residents, not all certainly, were hoping for, because a lot of residents were saying that these camps were making them feel unsafe. There were a lot of accusations of shootings, drug crime, you name it. But other residents were pushing back, saying this is not the right way. And right now, there's still a lot of questions. You know, it's not yet known how or when these existing encampments that are currently in Burien are going to be cleared, and who's going to be in charge of the efforts to clear them. How are the people who are living there going to get to the shelters, assuming that that space is available? These are all questions that I'm trying to follow up on.
One question is this, like, having a law like this, like a tool that can be used if they need it, but not necessarily used all the time, particularly if there aren't enough shelter beds? It's not like they're going to go out and sweep the camps. If these people can't be pointed toward shelter, they don't have to enforce this law, but it theoretically gives them the tool if they need it. Is that part of the rationale?
Felix, yes. I think cynics would say that this is just something to get on the books. And it's something that I heard many times when I was down in Burien covering this, that this was the appearance of doing something, but who knows how it's going to be carried out.
Wow. So I have a couple of questions. And I guess in my opinion, this is seen as getting something on the books, giving an additional tool. But there are a lot of questions that are unanswered. And one of the questions I have is, why is it that we have known that this homelessness issue exists, not just in Burien, but elsewhere? What number are we talking about in Burien itself? Have they given estimates?
I have not seen a single number. And I know that those point in time counts when it comes to surveying homeless populations are incredibly inaccurate. Because it's a point in time, and this is a population that is constantly revolving. People are going and moving between camps, or they're not staying there long enough. So the chance that every head would be counted at the exact moment where it's counted.
Well, they have to have an estimate. Otherwise, if you don't even know the extent of your problem, how are you going to find a solution?
I can give you a more regional estimate from King County Regional Housing Authority, and that would be 5,700 people without shelter in South King County, with only 529 emergency beds in that area.
Okay. You do the math. They have one-tenth of what they're, like, 500 over, with
529 beds compared to 5,700
people. Okay, yeah. So not even 10%. So we also know that there are no men's shelters in Burien, SeaTac, White Center, Tukwila, or Des Moines. They do have emergency shelters. They have two of them for families and women only.
I was just going to bring that up. Which adds to the complications of, I said that we don't know how these people who are in the existing encampments might be moved to the shelters where if there is available space, because those shelters are not in Burien.
So, yeah, so my point would be, okay, now you have this ordinance. Now you're saying you cannot sleep. So it's basically you cannot sleep in public, essentially what it is. It's 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., right?
Yes, it's overnight.
Yes. So you've taken this step. Now, what are you going to do to address the shelter? And why did you wait until this point to address the lack of shelter? I think that is where they have gone horribly wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, what about the regional homeless? Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The other thing I would also point out is that studies have shown that over 50% don't want shelter.
Yeah.
They may be offered shelter and they're refusing to take the shelter. So the question is, what do you do in that case?
Yeah, and the piecemeal approach. We're talking about Burien. Burien's not a very big place, and Burien's adjacent to Des Moines and White Center and, you know, unincorporated King County and Seattle. And homeless people are just as mobile as non-homeless people often. So where's the regional coordination? Isn't it something like the regional housing authority, regional homelessness authority? Shouldn't they be coordinating with all the different city jurisdictions, like we did with sewage 60 years ago?
Yeah, I'll answer that for you. Have you seen what's going on with the King County Regional Homelessness Authority?
No, I know. And I guess I'm asking a question I know the answer to, but I would love to see regional coordination. The same way we tackled, like, Lake Washington pollution 60 years ago, the sewage, which sewage is everywhere,
yes.
Right? We needed a regional authority to address it because you couldn't just address the sewage in Burien or in Kirkland. You had to address it regionally. Couldn't you? And not to say that unhoused people are sewage. Don't get me wrong. But the regional approach is just, this cries out for this. Why is there one ordinance in Burien that's different from an ordinance in nearby unincorporated White Center? It's crazy.
Because they want local control, because each city has different needs and different ideas.
That's just nutty.
But the idea of King County Regional Homelessness Authority was to try to coordinate it better.
All this stuff.
That organization in and of itself is in disarray. It has an interim.
Well, it became an organization that local leaders could point to and say, see, they're the ones who are supposed to be doing it. The heat is off me. One quick note about what some other cities are doing when they have a lack of shelter beds to move folks along. I know this happens in Edmonds, and I know this happens in Snohomish County. If we don't technically have shelter beds available for you, cities can still give out vouchers for a hotel room, right? So they can say, here is a voucher for a hotel room for you tonight. You can move along and go there. And if the person says, I don't want shelter, whether it's a hotel bed or whatever, then at least you have an ordinance on the books where they can say, okay, well, you're required to move along now, exactly. So we're going to make you do it.
Exactly. So for me, I look at it as an additional tool, and for that, I appreciate that they took the hard vote. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay, next story may be the most frustrating story of the morning. Okay, so we have to introduce you to a homeless homeowner in Seattle's Rainier Valley. And it may sound like a contradiction, but it's not. It's not a typo. It really is happening. So this guy's name is Jason Roth. He and his dog, Wally, live in a van, while the tenant who is living in his home owes him $29,000. So again, Jason and the dog in a van, his tenant owes him lots of rent. And Jason spoke with Cairo 7 TV's Jesse Jones, who did a fantastic job of the story. And Jason says his tenant owes him for 5 months of unpaid rent. But get this. The tenant is now renting out the downstairs of Jason's home on Airbnb for $434 a night.
He's, at the very least, he's generating $2,000 a month. And it's more than likely he's generating closer to three or possibly even four, depending on the month.
And even though he didn't own the home, the city gave the renter a short-term rental license.
So not only is he not paying me, but he's generating an income through the basement Airbnb unit. And meanwhile, I'm having to pay the utilities for that unit.
So Jason has been desperately trying to come up with some other solution. He's offered a payment plan, but apparently only got $100. He's tried dispute resolution. That failed as well.
The current process for an eviction hearing in King County to go from the start to the very end is about 12 months in total.
Attorney Ryan Weatherstone says in King County, courts are only hearing 6 cases per day.
Half of those hearings get automatically continued for another 3.5 months. So the court is only really hearing 3 hearings per day. And they're only hearing it for 4 days a week for the biggest county in Washington.
Okay, I'm trying to just deep breaths here. So now he's trying to evict the tenant, but there won't be an eviction hearing until late next month. So by the time it's all over, he says he's going to be out $50,000. So for now, he and Wally, his dog, continue to stay in that van in the driveway of his home, and his tenant is safely ensconced inside.
It makes me feel all kinds of different emotions. I mean, extreme sadness, anger, physical discomfort because of where I'm living. I'm on my own, which that to me might be the worst part, because there's always going to be people who abuse the system and scam, but the city should be there to recognize when that's happening. And nobody has been able to provide me any tangible assistance, anything significant.
Okay, I reached out to Jesse Jones, who, if someone's going to find a solution, it's going to be Jesse. So first of all, Jesse, I have confidence in Jesse in finding a solution to this. But how frustrating is that?
Yeah, and the Airbnb thing, it sort of popped up so quickly over the last decade. It becomes just such a totally upended the travel industry in general. And it's great, right? When you find a great Airbnb in some city you want to visit to stay in a cool apartment or something that's not at a hotel.
Yeah.
But then there's these unanticipated things like this. And this is a worst case scenario. In my neighborhood, there's an Airbnb across the street, and sometimes the people take up all the parking spots, and that's like an irritation. But I don't have to live in my van. I'm not renting out my house. But I can see how this is just like the fact the city would give this tenant a license to then continue renting out the basement. Something, you know, somewhere there's, you know, the dots aren't being connected properly that let this get to this point. And then everything's in favor of tenants in disputes like this, even though it's totally, appears to be clearly in favor of the landlord, you know, the owner of the property.
Well, here's my question too. 12 months for an eviction process?
Yeah. I think that's always been the case. And it's generally gotten more in favor of protecting tenants in recent years, which, because, you know, that's just not a bad thing necessarily, but people can abuse it, like this guy who's in.
Exactly. You know who else is dealing with this? Mike Lewis has shared that he is dealing with something like this as well.
Oh, he is. Okay.
With his property. I look at this and go, well, it's kind of guiding my decision making in terms of, do I want to, because we talked about, you know, we are going to be in the process of renting a place from my mother-in-law's old house.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we're going to find out what it's like to be a renter in Seattle.
Uh-huh.
I'm crossing my fingers.
Oh,
but then we were considering doing Airbnb. I don't have kids anymore in the house.
Yeah.
And we just, you know, updated our basement. Would that be a good thing? And I look at this story, I'm like,
well, this isn't the majority of stories, right?
It's a horror story. It's a nightmare scenario for sure.
I guess I understand why this happens, because policy-wise, the number one predictor of homelessness is an eviction. That's the number one way people go to homelessness. Mm-hmm. And I understand the need for, you know, tenant representation in eviction court, etc. However, if that process does not move efficiently,
correct,
then nobody is being served by that system.
No. And this guy who now somehow got the license, I don't even know what kind of license is that?
You have to get the city has a program to do short-term rental. You have to pay, it's like a couple hundred bucks, like a one-time fee to be a short-term renter.
Imagine the gall of renting out. You're not paying rent. And then Jesse Jones wrote in his story, he did see a shiny car with a new registration in the driveway as he walked out. I'm like,
I bet it's not fun to be neighbors of this house either. Based on what's going on, it wouldn't be fun to have Jason living in his van next door to your house either.
Poor Jason. Oh my gosh. Jesse will fix it. Okay, still ahead, Sully's going to join us. He's going to talk about why some freeways could get some new color lane striping. And we want to hear from you. What are the worst stretches of roadway where you're like, I need help seeing what's going on out here? Text us 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO. To the G and Ursula Show, Felix Bunnell is in today. So when you are driving in the dark and heavy rain, which buckle up, I feel like it's happening. Can you even see the lane stripes on the freeway?
Boy, not sometimes. So much anymore. I might need to get a new prescription. My glasses are a couple of years old. You know when you get new glasses and it's like you're looking into like thousands of, you can see the surface of Venus. And then like a year later, you're like, wait, what does that sign say? So it's partly due to my prescription.
Well, I think mine too. I used to be so proud of my eyesight, my great eyesight. I'm joining the rest of the crowd. But anyway, there might be a fix in the future because we're going to have some brand new technology when it comes to striping, right, Sully?
Well, we potentially, maybe.
Okay.
But only through construction zones. The story, MyNorthwest.com today, is kind of to remind everybody that the end of this pilot project in Fife is coming up. We've had them repaint these stripes on I-5, both north and southbound, through the construction zone in Fife with orange paint. So half of the stripe is white, the other half of it is orange.
Okay.
And the goal was, the idea was, the Federal Highway Administration gave the DOT some money here to test this out, to see if visually drivers see the orange in addition to all the other cues like the lowered speed limit and the construction, see if that makes people slow down, just as another visual cue that, hey, I'm in a construction zone, maybe I should slow down. And so they've been tracking this since July when they put in the paint, and they are, you know, collating data from their own traffic algorithms plus feedback from the public about whether or not this changed any behavior and made it slowly. And then Federal Highway Administration is going to look at this, and if it worked, we could see this popping up in construction zones around the country.
Okay.
So was it more about visibility, or was it about letting people know, hey, this is a construction zone when you see this
little,
orange
thing? A little bit of both. Okay. They're not exactly sure how the drivers were going to react to it. That's why they painted it this way.
Got it.
A couple other states have done this. From what I understand, they may have painted the whole stripe orange. They may have painted the fog light. They did it in different kinds of ways to see how the drivers responded, if at all. What I've heard from my drivers this morning, certainly on the text line, and what they've been telling me throughout this, is that no one's really paid attention. I mean, they don't pay attention to the lowered speed limit. They don't pay attention to the construction zone. And the orange lines didn't really mean anything to the drivers. The behavior stayed about the same. But again, that's anecdotal. The DOT has data that they're tracking. But yeah, it was just an experiment to see if, you know, adding this extra visual cue would get people to slow down in construction zones.
Kirk in Mount Vernon says, I went through that exact construction zone on Friday and it completely works. It actually makes the lines more visible. More defined. He says, I was hauling a truck and trailer and it helped immensely. I'm telling you, there are times when, especially when it's raining and it's dark, and I'm looking and I feel like I see three different lines.
And you might. Because, and here's the issue. There is so much construction going on our freeways around here that how many times on 405, for anybody who drives Renton, say, up into Bellevue through that widening project, have we had, this week you're going to be kind of driving to the inside. Next week, we move those work zones so frequently that they have to repaint the lines. And then when they move again, they kind of burn them off, but they still leave ghost lines there, so that when you're driving, the white line that is actually painted, that's active now, but you might be driving over a series of ghost lines in the middle of your lane where a week ago you were over to the left a little bit through a construction zone. It's been a huge problem. We went through it on I-90. Dave talks about it all the time. Even through the construction we've had on I-90 years ago, there are still the remnants of the ghost lines there. And so when it rains, it is very difficult to see. And yes, Washington does use reflective lane markers. They use a little bit of, I'm not sure, pixie dust they put in there in the paint that allows them to reflect off of the lights. But they spend repaint all summers long all over the place trying to deal with this. But you're right. It is a huge issue, especially when it starts raining like it has now.
Because when you drive on some newly constructed piece of highway and the lane markings are all brand new and those rumble strips are there, it's like, it's perfect. You don't think about it at all.
Oh, yeah. It feels so good. It's like great. It's like, I know where I am.
That stretch of I-90 along, was it like Ketchulis there?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Three or four lanes across, all nice and wide, clearly marked, never any problem there. Even when it's snowing and stuff, those lanes seem to really work.
Yeah, that's newer construction. That's only, 4 years old now.
Yeah. So. Now, Brian in Bellevue says it was something that I just experienced last week, especially when they had the Montlake exits cut closed on 520. Yeah. I accidentally ended up having to go all the way across the bridge and turn around and come back.
You got into the old Montlake loop.
I did that last night. I almost went westbound instead of eastbound last night because they changed the lanes around since the last time I was there, 2 days ago.
Yeah, when they closed those Montlake off ramps, you were like, wait a minute. Oh, now I got to pay a toll. And exactly. I got to go to Bellevue or Medina and turn around and then pay the toll coming back the other direction. Yeah, that's happened a lot. That's why whenever close 520, we have second collection. We're bringing in a vision. A visiting DOT member from Wisconsin.
Passed the basket for 520.
Oh, I thought I was out of church. No. So it's like that. And those things happen, unfortunately.
Chris, I'm a little bit confused because if DOT is saying, hey, look, we're going to try out this highly visible striping in construction zones because people don't notice the lane striping in other areas, isn't that an acknowledgement of how massive the problem is? And why would they only consider it for work zones when clearly we have an issue with drivers being able to see the existing lines?
Well, in this case, we've had almost 1,900 accidents in Washington work zones last year alone.
But can't we do both?
Well, again, that kind of a change needs to go through the Federal Highway Administration. You cannot make there's a book that is the size of probably the budget that they're trying to figure out in D.C. right now that tells you the size of signs, the size of stripes, the colors that you can use, and those things need to go through the standard.
But what about actual lane reflectors, right? The bumps that stick up, they're not just painted stripes with the reflective glitter in it, but actual reflectors, lane reflectors, those are visible in the dark.
On neighborhood streets or like where you see the blue ones where there are fire hydrants. Yeah. In case anybody didn't know, that's what the blue raised ones are. Yep. That means there's a fire hydrant nearby. But again, that would have to be passed and become uniform on the federal highway system in order for that to happen on our freeways. Wow. Because that's the way it works. There's a uniform standard for signs and painting
which
that goes
great,
onto our freeways.
Because you can fly into any city in the States, rent a car, and you drive somewhere, and you know exactly what to do based on the painting. If you can see
pretty
it.
Much, you know. Yeah. Yeah. However, as I've found out recently, the people in Idaho, Montana, and North South Dakota really do not know how to zipper merge.
Oh, boy, it's not just us, then.
I nearly got killed by a truck driver who did not like the fact that I bypassed a two-mile line! 2 miles in South Dakota! Where are you guys going? I didn't know there were that many people in South Dakota that time.
We're going to save that passion for zipper merge till tomorrow. How's that?
Sure. Yeah, whatever.
See you on the Rumble strips.
Yeah. Yeah, enjoy the ghost lines, everybody.
It sounds like maybe 70, 75%, at least on our text line, enjoyed.
Well, good. I'm glad.
The orange striping.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Anything to keep the accidents down in those work zones is a plus for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chris.
Sure.
Okay, We Need to Talk is coming up next. How do you fight retail theft? Well, there is one big retailer that says the answer is to hire more people and pay them well. We'll tell you who that is and why that is working coming up next on the G and Ursula Show. I'm doing karaoke.
Put one of Ursula's favorites over there.
Thank you, Nick. Welcome back to the G and Ursula Show. One of the topics that we bring up often is shoplifting and retail theft, which is a problem that costs stores and all of us, really, over $100 billion a year. And our state has committed $1.5 million to an organized retail theft task force, but let's face it, it seems like an impossible problem to solve unless you have armed officers standing outside of every store exit, something I have seen more often. But even when I have seen those big, burly security officers out in, for example, Fred Meyer on Lake City.
Yeah.
I see theft every single time.
Really?
I go. Every time. Maybe it's because I go at night.
Wow. Okay.
But I see it all the time. Some stores, you've noticed, are already putting all their inventory behind locked cases. I actually took pictures because there were things at that very same Fred Meyer. I'm like, you're putting that behind a locked case?
Like really, really low end kind of stuff? Like what sort of stuff?
Stuff under $20.
Okay.
Toothpaste. I mean, even toothpaste. Certain types of toothpaste. I'm like, wait a minute. Why this? And it was kind of toward the front of the store. But I saw this article and I thought this was really interesting because Lowe's, hardware stores, doesn't seem to have that same problem that many other big retailers have. And the CEO of Lowe's was asked, and he says the answer is we pay our people well and we hire more people. So in essence, one of the big problems, he says, is that there just aren't enough people working at a lot of these stores. And when I think about it, it's true.
Yeah.
Like the place I see the most theft is Rite Aid, the Rite Aid in my neighborhood.
Yes. I often have to go into the back, into the employee section to find the one person outside of the pharmacist who is working in the store to get them to ring me up.
Exactly.
I've thought about just walking out multiple times.
Okay. Yeah. I've never thought about that, but I...
Retail has just been destroyed. The fun part of retail, right? I mean, all this shoplifting stuff aside, the fact there's all these layers of security and everything, the fact there's nobody there, and the fact it's Rite Aid and not Bartels, although that was probably Rite Aid for a long time, right?
Yeah, I mean,
I know you guys talk about Bartels all the time, I'm always excited when you talk about it, because that's just...
I love Bartels.
That was such a loss to have a locally owned company. Now I don't know where to go to buy stuff and feel like I'm contributing to a local business.
Catterman's.
When it comes to stuff like... Yes, I've been there
on
before.
Sandpoint.
Yeah, I know that place.
This is very Seattle-centric, but you all know where you've got that family-owned pharmacy or that family.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the answer, but even those are few and far between. But Lowe's CEO, his name is Marvin Ellison. He says his stores pay on the higher end of the wage scale for comparable retailers. And he says more complete associate training is effectively cutting shoplifting.
Absolutely.
So if you look at it and you think about it, that's an investment to make, because so many stores are just cutting back.
Yep.
The other night, I was telling G, I was at Fred Meyer at Lake City, and I was in a section. I was looking at the vitamin section. I was like, okay, I need to start taking a vitamin. So I was taking a little bit of time. It's toward the back of the store. Okay, don't laugh. I'm getting older.
One a day.
Yeah. So I'm back there, and the alarms go off, and I see there's an exit. And someone went through the exit. The alarms are going off for the entire store. Now, when I walked into that Fred Meyer, there was one of those big, burly security guards and another security guard talking to him in the front. It was 4 minutes before because I was like, okay, let's see how long it takes someone to respond. Yeah. It was 4 minutes before two employees go running back there. There's no one anymore. A customer comes around the corner. Is like, it was someone with a... Okay, sadly, it was like someone wearing a white hoodie and just walked out with a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
If you don't have enough people working, it makes it very easy for the thieves. And again, not to blame the victim, but it made sense for me, like for this CEO to say, well, at Lowe's, we just believe that effective customer service with more sales associates on the floor approaching customers is a very effective deterrent. Yep. Sure enough, the last time I went to Lowe's, I had help.
Yeah, I guess it would deter the thieves, but also makes the customers who aren't thieves happier to be there. Because like sometimes you go to one of those big box hardware stores and you're trying to find this particular sort of socket or whatever, and there's nobody.
Yes.
And there's 5,000 things to choose from. And there's obviously three or four different kinds that might work for what you're trying to fix.
Yes.
And you just feel frustrated and you think, like, what do I have to do to get help around here? So,
yes.
But if somebody's there and helps you, then you feel like you become a loyal customer. You're more likely to spend your money there, especially if they're employing more people, too.
Right.
I'm so annoyed. I am so annoyed that we have been talking about this for 2 years, and not once during that time have we brought up the fact that stores are underfunding their own customer service. And like, absolutely. If you choose to operate your store on a complete skeleton staff, to the point where I walk into any grocery store and I'm buying groceries for the family, I know I'm bagging them all because there's going to be one checker up front,
yes.
Maybe two if it's busy, and then maybe someone running 12 self-checkout lanes, and geez. People walk out with stuff in that kind of environment. I'm just infuriated with myself for being such an idiot and not thinking about this earlier.
Well, that's so funny that...
Well, one more thing.
I mean, reading the story, I mean, it was like, hello, duh.
Here's why it bothers me the most, though, is because we've had all these conversations. We have a state-level task force dedicated to combating this problem, so I don't want to victim blame. But when we have stores and CEOs coming out and saying, this is a societal problem, this is something that we need the state to step in and fix, well, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're putting everything behind cases to make it terrible for customers. You're asking for tax dollars to police your stores. How about just putting people in your stores? Yeah. Great job, Lowe's.
Yeah, well,
exactly.
They have shareholders they have to respond to, right? Especially if you're a big company like Lowe's or Target or whatever. But if you can communicate to those shareholders that long term, it's better to invest in your community with more jobs and you get better customer satisfaction.
Exactly.
It's the big picture, but nobody's focused on the big picture. They're focused on that quarter's particular earnings report and how good or bad they're going to look in front of the board. So,
okay, yeah, good on Lowe's. 360 texted and said, I work at a grocery store. We have an eyedrop theft ring going around Western Washington.
God.
Remember I was saying, it was like, now it's like the common stuff.
Yeah, yeah, not just those overpriced toothbrush heads for those stupid electric toothbrushes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, still ahead, what's new at 10? This is the G and Ursula Show.